has transformed.
They've been working on it for weeks, Byron said. I told you.
Siena's main piazza was one of the sights of Italy. The forgotten town planners of the Middle Ages had designed a memorably beautiful open space, hemmed in by a semicircular sweep of reddish palazzos and the imposing, almost straight facade of the 14th-century town hall, all overarched by the blue sky of Tuscany and pierced heavenward by the red stone bell tower of the town hall, more than 350 feet high. All year round, the vast, shell-shaped space was empty except for market stalls and scattered foot traffic, and the ancient buildings that ringed it seemed abandoned or asleep. Today, in the golden light of a late afternoon sun, it was a sea of people, surging and roaring inside a ring of wooden barriers. Between these barriers and the palazzo walls lay a track of earth. And against the walls were steep banks of temporary benches. Faces crowded at every window of every building around the piazza. Flags and rich hangings decorated the palazzos. The benches were jammed. All the roofs were jammed. The great central space looked full, and yet from half a dozen narrow streets more people were streaming across the track and jamming themselves in. The parade was now going around the track of earth, and all the contrade at once were doing the flag whirls, the flings, the arabesques, to continuous plaudits of the throng and the cacophonous blare of many brass bands. Byron led the way to their seats, still holding Jastrow's thin arm. "Well, hasn't the Archbishop done us proud?" said the professor, as they settled on a narrow, splintery plank directly below the judge's stand. "One couldn't have a better view of the thing." He laughed without reason, obviously feeling better out of the press of bodies. "See the mattresses?" said Natalie gaily. "There they are, down at the corners." "Oh, yes, my lord, what an extraordinary business!" The noise of the crowd rose into a general cheer. A wooden cart, drawn by four white Tuscan oxen with giant curved horns, was entering the track, surrounded by marchers in rich costume. On a tall pole in the cart swayed the pallio. "Why, it's an Assumption!" said Jastrow, peering through small binoculars at the narrow painted cloth. "Naive, but not bad at all." Around the piazza the cart slowly rolled, with helmeted policemen behind it driving the crowd from the track, while sweepers cleared up papers and trash. By now the paved square was one dense mass of white shirts, colored dresses, and dark heads, bringing out the half-moon shape of the track and its danger. The red palazzos sloped downward to the town hall, where a straight street sliced off the broad curve. Heavy mattresses padded the outer barriers at these sharply cut corners. Even at the trial runs, Byron and Natalie had seen horses thud against the mattresses and knock their jockeys senseless. The sunset light on the facade of the Palazzo Pubblico, the town hall, was deepening to a blood color. The rest of the piazza was in shadow, and a heavy bell was tolling in the tower. From the town hall, a long fanfare sounded. The crowd fell quiet. Trumpets struck up the old pallio march that had been echoing all week in Siena's streets. Out of the palazzo courtyard trotted the caparisoned racehorses with their flamboyantly costumed jockeys. Natalie Jastrow's fingers slid into Byron's and clasped them, and for a moment she put her cheek, cool, bony, and yet soft, against his. "Idiotic, Briny?" she murmured. He was too delighted with the contact to answer. The starting line was directly in front of them, and behind them, above the judge's stand, the pallio hung on its pole, stirring in a cool breeze blowing across the great amphitheater.
An ancient contraption of wood and rope controlled the start. To line up the dancing, overwrought animals inside the ropes proved almost impossible. The harried creatures capered in and out. They turned, reared, stumbled, and broke away twice in false starts. At last, the 10 horses went thudding off in a pack, with the jockeys clubbing wildly at the creatures and at each other. A yell rose above the steady roar as 2 horses went down at the first set of mattresses. After that, Byron lost track of the race. While he watched an unconscious jockey being dragged off the dirt, another wild yell of the crowd told of more mishaps, which he couldn't see. The pack came racing by in a club-waving, dirt-flying jumble, strung out over 5 or 6 lengths. A riderless horse galloped well up among them, dripping foam, its reins dangling. "Can a riderless horse win?" Jastrow shouted at Byron. A man in the row below him turned up a fat, warty red face with pointed mustaches and popping yellow eyes.
"See, see, riderless is a scozzo, mister, scozzo. Viva Bruco, scozzo!"
When the pack came past the judge's box a second time, the riderless horse was clearly in the lead, and Byron could see its caterpillar colors and emblems.
"Scozzo!"
The warty red face turned and bellowed happily at Dr. Jastrow, exhaling heavy odors of garlic and wine, and 2 fists waved at him.
"See, mister? Ooh, Bruco! Caterpillar, mister!"
"Yes, indeed, just so," said Jastrow, shrinking a bit against Byron. The noise in the piazza swelled to a general mad scream as the horses went round for the 3rd and last time, with the surviving jockeys frantically beating their nags to make them overtake the riderless Bruco horse. They came past the finish in a shower of dirt, a maze of bobbing, straining heads, and flailing jockeys' arms. The riderless horse, its eyes rolling redly, was still barely in front.
"Bruco!"
screamed the warty man, leaping a couple of feet in the air.
"Scosso! Scosso!"
He turned to Jastrow with a maniacal laugh and vividly gestured that the horse was drugged by pumping a huge imaginary hypodermic needle into his arm.
"Bravissimo! Woo!"
He clattered down the narrow aisle to the track, ran onto the dirt, and vanished in the swarm, boiling out of the seats and over the barriers. The track was full on the instant, with people milling, yelling, waving arms, jumping and embracing in ecstasy, shaking fists, clutching their heads, beating their breasts. Here and there in the mob were the bobbing, plumed heads of the horses. On the track, before the judges' stand, 12 white-shirted young men were beating an unhelmeted jockey, on his knees in the dirt, holding up both arms in a plea for mercy. The jockey's face was welling bright blood.
"My lord, what's going on there?" Jastrow quavered.
"Somebody failed to double-cross," Byron said, "or else he triple-crossed."
"I suppose," Jastrow put a trembling hand to his beard, "this is the part the Archbishop warned us about. Perhaps we had better leave, and—"
Byron slammed an arm across his chest. "Not now. Sit right where you are, sir, and don't move. You too, Natalie." A squad of young men, with yellow and green caterpillar scarves around their necks, came driving through the mob straight for the judge's stand. They trampled up the benches, past Jastrow, led by a pallid youngster streaming blood from his forehead. Byron held 2 protecting arms in front of the girl and Jastrow as the bloody-faced one seized the pole. The whole squad roared, cheered, and came thundering back down the benches with the banner.
"Now," Byron took the hands of the other two. Come. The excited Sienese, as well as the tourists, were prudently making way for the triumphant caterpillars. Moving right behind them, with one arm around the girl and another around Jastrow, Byron got through the archway into the main lower street of the town. But here the mob eddied in behind the palio and its triumphant escort and engulfed them, crushing uphill toward the cathedral.
"Oh, Lord," Natalie said. "We're in for it now. Hang on to Aaron."
"Dear me, I'm afraid I didn't bargain for this,"
gasped Jastrow, fumbling at his hat and his glasses with one free hand. The other was pinned in Byron's grip.
"My feet are scarcely touching the ground, Byron."
"That's okay. Don't fight them, sir. Just go along. At the first side street, this jam will ease up. Take it easy." A convulsive, panicky surge of the crowd at this moment tore the professor out of Byron's grasp. Behind them sounded the clatter of hooves on stone, wild neighs and whinnies, and shouts of alarm. The crowd melted around Byron and Natalie, fleeing from a plunging horse. It was the winner, the caterpillar animal. A brawny young man in green and yellow, his wig awry and sliding, was desperately trying to control the animal. But as it reared again, a flailing front hoof caught him full in the face. He fell, bloodied, to the ground, and the horse was free. It danced, reared, and screamed, plunging forward, and the crowd shrank away. As Byron pulled Natalie into a doorway out of the retreating mob, Aaron Jastrow emerged in the clear street without his glasses, stumbled, and fell in the horse's path. Without a word to Natalie, Byron ran out into the street and snatched Jastrow's big yellow hat off his head. He waved the hat in the horse's face, crouching, watching the hooves. The creature neighed wildly, shied against a palazzo wall, stumbled, and lost its footing, then recovered and reared, flailing its forelegs at Byron, who waved the hat again, staying watchfully just out of range. The horse pranced about on two legs, rolling bloodshot, mad eyes, foaming at the mouth. Half a dozen men in caterpillar costumes now came running up the street, and four of them seized the reins, dragged the horse down, and began to quiet him. The others picked up their injured comrade. People from the crowd darted out and helped Jastrow get up. Natalie ran to his side. Men surrounded Byron, slapping his shoulder and shouting in Italian as he made his way to Jastrow. "Here's your hat, sir."
"Oh, thank you, Byron. My glasses. You haven't seen them, have you? I suppose they're shattered. Well, I have another pair at the villa."
The professor was blinking blindly, but he acted rather excited and cheerful.
"Goodness, what a commotion! What happened? I was pushed down, I guess. I heard a horse clattering about, but I couldn't see a thing."
"He's all right," Natalie said to Byron, with a look straight into his eyes such as she had never before given him.
"Thanks."
"Dr. Jastrow, if you're not too shaken up," Byron said, taking his arm again, "we should go to the Caterpillar Church for the Thanksgiving service."
"Oh, not at all," Jastrow laughed. The moment of action seemed to have cleared his nerves. "In for a penny, in for a pound. I find all this rather exhilarating. On we go. Just hang on to me a little better, Byron. You were a bit derelict there for a minute."
A week or so later, Natalie and Byron were at work in the library, with a summer thunderstorm beating outside at the darkened windows. Byron, happening to look up from a map when lightning flashed, saw Natalie staring at him, her face somber in the lamplight.
"Byron, have you ever been to Warsaw?"
"No. Why?"
"Would you like to come there with me?"
With great willpower, choking back his joy,
Byron summoned up the opaque, dull look with which he had resisted 20 years of his father's probings. What would be the point?
Well, it's probably worth seeing, don't you think? Sloat even says it's rather old-world and gay. The thing is, Aaron's getting difficult about my trip. You know that. I could just tell him to go to hell, but I'd rather not.
Byron had heard the discussions. In the aftermath of the polio, on learning how close he had come to getting injured or killed, Jastrow was having a spell of nerves. The American consul in Florence had come up after the polio for a visit. Following that, Jastrow's glum mood had worsened. He kept insisting that the Foreign Service was getting worried over the Polish situation and that Natalie's proposed trip was now too risky. Byron said, "Would my going make a difference?"
"Yes, you know what Aaron calls you behind your back now, that golden lad. He can't get over what you did at the polio."
"You exaggerated it."
"I did not. You showed striking presence of mind. I was impressed. And so was Aaron, when he found out. The horse might have killed him."
"If I can tell him you're coming, I bet he'll stop grumbling."
"Your friend Sloat might take a dim view of my showing up with you."
Natalie said with a grim little smile, "I'll handle Leslie Sloat, all right?"
"I'll think about it," Byron said.
"If you need money, I'll be glad to lend you some."
"Oh, I've got money. As a matter of fact, Natalie, there's not all that much to think about. I guess I'll come along."
"With Jastrow off in Greece, this will be a dismal place."
"Bless your heart." She gave him a delighted smile. "We'll have fun. I'll see to that."
"What happens after Warsaw?" Byron said. "Will you come back here?"
"I guess so, if the consul doesn't persuade Aaron to go home meantime. He's really working on him."
"And you, Briny?"
"Well, maybe I will too," Byron said. "I'm at loose ends."
That night at dinner, when he heard the news, Dr. Jastrow ordered up a bottle of champagne.
"Byron, I can't tell you what a load you've taken off my mind. This headstrong girl doesn't know how wild and backward Poland is. I do. From what my relatives write me, it hasn't improved one iota since I left there 45 years ago. And the situation really is unstable. The villain with the mustache is making nasty noises, and we must look for the worst. However, there's bound to be some warning. My mind is much more at ease now. You're a capable young man."
"You talk as though I were some kind of idiot," Natalie said, sipping champagne.
"You are a girl. It's something you have trouble remembering. You were that way as a child, climbing trees and fighting boys. Well, I'll be here alone, then, but I won't mind that."
"Won't you be in Greece, sir?" Byron said.
"I'm not so sure." Jastrow smiled at their puzzled looks. "It's some clumsiness about my passport. I let it lapse, and not being native-born, but naturalized through my father's naturalization, it turns out there's a bit of red tape involved in renewing it, especially since I haven't been back in 9 years. The problem may or may not be unraveled by the end of August. If it isn't, I'll just take the trip next spring."
"That's something you should certainly straighten out," Byron said.
"Oh, of course. These things used to be simple, the consul says, but since the flood of refugees from Hitler began, the rules have tightened up. Well, Briny, so you and Natalie will be off to Warsaw in a few weeks. I couldn't be more pleased, and I'm sure she can use a chaperone."
"Go climb a tree, Aaron," Natalie said, turning pink, and her uncle laughed at her, his first wholehearted laugh in a week.
"I hope you'll manage to meet my cousin, Beryl," Jastrow said to Byron. "I haven't seen him since I left Poland,
but we've usually exchanged 3 or 4 letters a year. Presence of mind has always been his strong point, too.
Chapter 6 Pamela drove Commander Henry and her father to Svinemunda. The train would have been faster, but Henry wanted to see the countryside and the small towns, and the Englishman was more than agreeable. One could almost get to like Germans, he said, if one stayed out of the cities. Pug was appalled at the girl's driving. She chauffeured the rented Mercedes around Berlin in docile conformity to the lights and the speed laws, but once on the Autobahn, she rocketed the needle to 150 kilometers an hour. Tudsbury chatted over the wind roar, paying little attention to the scenery blurring past. He now thought there might be no war. The British were dealing seriously at last with the Russians about a military alliance. They were starting to turn out airplanes so much faster that regaining air parity, which they had lost in 1936, was in sight. Their pledge to Poland showed Hitler that this time Chamberlain meant business. The Nazi Party in Danzig had quieted down. Mussolini had flatly told Hitler, so Tudsbury's inside information had it, that he was not ready to fight. The correspondent foresaw a respite of 2 or 3 years, during which the alarmed democracies would rearm faster than the Germans possibly could. The cornered dictator would eventually either fall or start a war and be crushed, or very likely get assassinated.
"I can't understand why somebody hasn't shot him long ago, the way he shows himself. He bears a charm,"
Tudsbury shouted, as the car careered out on the 2-lane road to pass a long line of thundering trucks full of new, gray-painted army tanks. Pug Henry clutched at an armrest, for another truck was approaching head-on, swelling like a balloon. It went by in a howl and a screech, half a second after Pamela whisked into her own lane between two trucks, brushing hair off her forehead with one relaxed little hand.
"But the charm is based on success. It may lapse once he stops moving ahead. He's murdered a lot of people on the way up. They all have relatives."
Commander Grobka came to meet them at the base gate in a small car, which Tudsbury could barely squeeze into. Pamela roared off to a hotel, and Grobka took the two men for a long tour, by car and on foot, through the Svinemunde yard. It was a gray afternoon, with low black clouds threatening rain. The dank east wind off the Baltic felt pleasantly cool after the sultriness of Berlin. The flat, sandy, bleak seacoast base was much like New London, Victor Henry thought. If one ignored flags and signs, in fact, the naval facilities of big powers were hard to tell apart. They were all in the same business, imitating the British Navy, which had first brought the industrial age to war at sea. The low black U-boats tied in clusters to the long piers or resting on blocks in dry docks, the smell of tar, hot metal, and seawater, the slow clank and screech of overhead cranes, the blaze of welding torches, the rattle of riveters, the flat or curved sections of steel painted with yellow or red primer swinging through the air, the gigantic open sheds, the mounds of piping, cables, timbers, and oil drums, the swarms of grease-blackened, cheerful men in dirty coveralls, goggles, and hard hats, the half-finished hulls propped with timbers on rails slanting into dirty water. He might have been in Japan, France, Italy, or the United States. The differences that counted, the crucial numbers and performance characteristics, were not discernible.
He could see that the Germans were not changing the classic double hull of a submarine, and that, like the Americans, they were doing more welding. He would have liked to apply his pocket tape measure to a steel pressure hull section. The plate seemed thinner than in American submarines. If this were so, U-boats could probably not dive quite as deep, unless the Germans had developed a remarkably strong new alloy. But on such a visit, one used one's eye, not a camera or a tape measure. A low sun broke out under the gray clouds, and the car cast an elongated shadow when Grobka stopped near the entrance gate at a dry dock where a U-boat rested on blocks. From one side of the dock, a gangway with rails, and from the other, a precarious long plank slanted down to the submarine's deck.
"Well, that's the tour," said Grobka. "This is my flagship. Since I cannot have you aboard, Tudsbury, much as I would like to, I suppose we all part company here."
Henry picked up his cue from the German's smile.
"Look, let's not stand on ceremony. If I can come aboard, I'll come, and Tudsbury won't."
"Good God, yes," said the Englishman. "I've no business here, anyway."
The U-boat commander spread his hands.
"I don't want to drive a wedge in Anglo-American friendship."
A whistle blasted as they spoke, and workmen came trooping off the boats and docks, and out of the sheds. The road to the gate was soon thronged with them. They came boiling out of the U-boat, up the gangway.
"The old Navy Yard hazard," Henry said. "Run for your life at 5 o'clock, or they'll trample you to death."
Grobka laughed.
"All civilians are the same."
Tudsbury said,
"Well, in my next broadcast, I'll have to say that the U-boat command is humming like damn all. I hope they'll take notice in London."
"Just tell them what you saw."
Grobka shook his hand through the car window.
"We want to be friends. We know you have the greatest navy in the world. These little boats can do a lot of damage for their size, that's all. One of my officers will drive you to your hotel."
Since workmen were jamming the gangway, Grobka grinned at Henry and pointed a thumb toward the plank on the other side of the dock. Pug nodded. The German, with a gesture, invited him to go first. It was a very long drop, something like 70 feet, to the greasy puddles on the concrete dock. Pug made his way around the rim and walked down the shaky, paint-spotted plank, trying to look easier than he felt. Stolid eyes of side boys in white watched from below. As he set foot on deck, they snapped to attention. Grobka stepped off the rattling plank with a laugh.
"Well done for two old blokes."
U-46 looked much like an American submarine, but the cleanliness, polish, and order were unusual. A United States ship in dry dock, with civilian workmen aboard, soon became squalid and dirty. No doubt Grobka had ordered a clean-up for the American visitor, which Pug appreciated, being himself a spit-and-polish tyrant. Even so, he had to admire the German display. The diesels looked as though they had never turned over. Their red paint and brass fittings were unsullied by a grease spot, and the batteries seemed fresh from the factory. The sailors were starched, pretty fellows, almost a crew for a nautical musical comedy. As for the U-boat design, when you took the essential spaces and machines of a war vessel and stuffed them into the sausage casing of one long tube, the result was the same in any country. Change the instrument legends to English, move the captain's cabin from port to starboard, add 2 feet to the wardroom, alter a few valve installations, and you were in the grayling.
"Smells pretty good," he said, as they passed the tiny galley,
where cooks in white were preparing dinner and somehow managing to perspire neatly. Grobka looked at him over his shoulder.
"You wouldn't care to eat aboard. It's awfully cramped, but these chaps don't eat too badly."
Pug had a dinner appointment with the Tudsburys, but he said at once, "I'd be delighted." So he dined elbow to elbow with the captain and officers of the U-boat in the narrow wardroom. He enjoyed it. He was more at home here than in his silk-walled dining room in Berlin. The four young officers were thin-lipped, ruddy, blonde, shy, like Americans in their features, but with a different look around the eyes, more intense and wary. They sat silent at first, but soon warmed to the Americans' compliments about the boat and the joking of Grobka, who got into an excellent mood over the food and wine. Stories passed about the stupidity and laziness of Navy Yard workmen. One of Pug's best yarns, an incident of crossed-up toilet plumbing on the West Virginia, brought uproarious laughter. He had noticed before the German taste for bathroom humor. The officers told tales, which they considered comic, of their early training. First about the cleaning of latrines, then of electric shocks to which they had had to submit without flinching while their reactions were filmed. Exposure to cold and heat past the point of collapse. Knee bends until they dropped. The Valley of Death cross-country run up and down hillsides, wearing 70-pound loads and gas masks. An officer emerged the better, they said, from such ordeals. Only Grobka disagreed. That Prussian sadism was old-fashioned, he asserted. In war at sea, initiative was more important than the blind submission that the ordeals implanted.
"The Americans have the right idea," he said,
either because he sensed that Pug was shocked or out of maverick conviction. They feasted on cabbage soup, boiled fresh salmon, roast pork, potato dumplings, and gooseberry torten. Obviously, Grobka had ordered up this banquet on the chance that Pug might stay. Streaks of red sunset showed through the black rain clouds when Henry and Grobka left the submarine. On the dock, some crewmen, naked except for trunks, were wrestling inside a cheering circle on gray mats laid over the crane tracks. Henry had seen everywhere this love of young Germans for hard horseplay. They were like healthy pups, and these U-boat men looked stronger and healthier than American sailors.
"So, Henry, I suppose you join your English friend now."
"Not if you have any better ideas."
The German slapped him on the shoulder.
"Good. Come along."
They drove out through the gate.
"Damn quiet after 5 o'clock," said Pug.
"Oh, yes, dead. Always."
Pug lit a cigarette.
"I understand the British are working 2 and 3 shifts now in their yards."
Grobka gave him an odd look.
"I guess they make up for lost time."
A couple of miles from the base, amid green fields near the water, they drove into rows of wooden cottages.
"Here's where my daughter lives,"
Grobka said, ringing a doorbell. A fresh-faced young blonde woman opened the door. 3 children, recognizing Grobka's ring, ran and pounced on the paper-wrapped hard candies he handed out. The husband was at sea, on maneuvers. On an upright piano in the tiny parlor stood his picture. Young, long-jawed, blonde, stern.
"It's good Paul is at sea," Grobka said. "He thinks I spoil the kids."
And he proceeded to toss them and romp with them until they lost their bashfulness in the presence of the American and ran around laughing and shrieking. The mother tried to press coffee and cake on the guests, but Grobka stopped her.
"The commander is busy. I just wanted to see the children. Now we go."
As they got into the car, looking back at the window where three little faces peered out at him, he said,
"It's not much of a house, not like your mansion in the Grunwald. It's just a cracker box. The German pay scale isn't like the American. I thought you'd be interested to see how they live. He's a good U-boat officer, and they're happy. He'll have a command in 2 years. Right away, if there's war. But there won't be war, not now."
"I hope not."
"I know. There is not going to be a war over Poland. So, back to Swinemunde?"
"I guess so." As they drove into the small coastal town, Pug said,
"Say, I could stand a beer. How about you? Is there a good place?"
"Now you're talking. There's nothing fancy, not in this boring town, but I can take you where the officers hang out. Isn't Tudsbury expecting you?"
"He'll survive."
"Yes, Englishmen are good at that."
Grobka laughed with transparent pleasure at keeping the American naval attaché from the famous correspondent. Young men in turtleneck sweaters and rough jackets sat at long tables in the dark, smoky, timbered cellar, bellowing a song to concertina accompaniment played by a strolling fat man in a leather apron.
"Jesus Christ, I have drunk a lot of beer in this place, Henry," said Grobka.
They sat at a small side table under an amber lamp. Pug showed him pictures of Warren, Byron, and Madeline. After a couple of beers, he told of his worry over Warren's involvement with an older woman. Grobka chuckled.
"Well, the things I did when I was a young buck. The main thing is, he'll be an aviator. Not as good as a submariner, but the next best thing. He looks like a smart lad. He'll settle down."
Pug joined in a song he recognized. He had no ear and sang badly off key. This struck Grobka as hilarious.
"I swear to God, Victor,"
he said, wiping his eyes after a fit of laughter,
"could anything be crazier than all this talk of war? I tell you, if you left it to the Navy fellows on both sides, it could never happen. We're all decent fellows. We understand each other. We all want the same things out of life. It's the politicians. Hitler is a great man, and Roosevelt is a great man, but they've both been getting some damn lousy advice. But there's one good thing. Adolf Hitler is smarter than all the politicians. There's not going to be any war over Poland."
He drained his thick glass stein and banged it to attract a passing barmaid.
"Geben Sie gut acht auf den Asten," he said,
winking and dropping his voice.
"Watch the east. There's something doing in the east."
The barmaid clacked on the table two foaming steins from clusters in her hands. Grobka drank and passed the back of his hand over his mouth.
"Suppose I tell you that I heard the Fuhrer himself address the senior U-boat command and tell them there would be no war. You want to report that back to Washington? Go ahead. It happens to be true. You think he'll start a war against England with 74 operational U-boats? When we have 300, that'll be a different story. And then England will think twice about making trouble. And in 18 months, that's exactly what we'll have. Meantime, watch the east."
"Watch the east," Victor Henry said in a wondering tone.
"Aha, you're a little curious. I have a brother in the foreign ministry. Watch the east. We're not going to be fighting, Henry, not this year, I promise you.
So, what the hell? We live 1 year at a time, no? Come on, I have a tin ear like you, but we'll sing.
Victor Henry sat with his old portable typewriter on his knees in the rosewood-paneled library. The magnificent antique desk was too high for comfortable typing, and anyway, the machine scratched the red leather top. It was not yet 4 in the morning, but the stars were gone. Blue day showed in the garden, and birds sang. White paper, yellow paper, and carbons lay raggedly around him. The room was cloudy with smoke. He had been typing since midnight. He stopped, yawning. In the kitchen he found a cold chicken breast, which he ate with a glass of milk, while he heated a third pot of coffee. He returned to the library, gathered up the top white pages of his report to the Office of Naval Intelligence, and began reading. Combat Readiness of Nazi Germany. An appraisal. Nazi Germany is a very peculiar country. The contradictions strike the observer as soon as he arrives. The old Germany is still here. The medieval buildings, the quaint country costumes, the clean big cities, the order, the good nature, the neatness, the thoroughness, the beautiful scenery, the fine-looking people, especially the children. However, there is an extra layer of something new and different. The Nazi regime. It's all over the face of this old country like a rash. How deep it goes is a serious question. The Nazis have certainly put up a highly patriotic, colorful, and warlike facade. The swastika flags, new buildings, marching battalions, Hitler Youth, torchlight parades and such are all very striking. But what is behind the facade? Is there a strong potential for war-making, or is it mainly political propaganda and bluff? This report gives the first impressions of an officer who has been in Germany 4 weeks and has been digging for facts. It is common knowledge that since 1933, Germany has been frankly and even boastfully rearming. Even before the Hitler regime, however, the army surreptitiously armed and trained in violation of the Versailles Treaty, with Bolshevik help. Once the Nazis took power, though the Russian contact was dropped, the rearming speeded up and became open. Nevertheless, 20 years ago this nation was disarmed. 7 years ago it was still helpless compared to the Allies. The question is, to what extent has that gap been closed by Hitler? Building a modern combat force is a big-scale industrial process. It takes material, manpower, and time, no matter what vaunting claims political leaders make. Two preliminary and interesting conclusions emerge from the facts this observer has been able to gather. One, Nazi Germany has not closed the gap sufficiently to embark on a war with England and France. Two, the regime is not making an all-out effort to close the gap. The next 5 pages contained 10-year figures, contradicting many intelligence reports he had read, of German factory production, of the expansion of industry, and of the output of machines and materials. He drew heavily on his own reading and inquiries. He presented comparisons of French, British, and German gross national products and of strength on land, sea, and in the air during this decade. These numbers indicated, as he marshaled them, that Germany remained inferior in every aspect of war-making except for her air force, and that she was not pushing her industrial plant very hard to catch up. Contrary to popular opinion all over the world, there was no feverish piling of arms. This emerged by a comparison of plant capacity and output figures.
He described, in passing, the desolate peace that fell over the Svinamunda Navy Yard at the usual quitting time. There was not even a second shift for constructing U-boats, the key to German sea warfare. He argued that the edge in the air would rapidly melt away with the present British speed-up in making airplanes and buying them from the United States. As to land war, the swarming uniforms in the city streets were quite a show, but the figures proved that France alone could put a larger, longer-trained, and better-equipped army in the field. On a U-boat, passing through the squadron's tiny flag office, he had seen, scrawled on the outside of a mimeographed report, some figures and abbreviations that he thought meant Operational 51. At C6, in Port 40, Overhaul 5. These figures met the intelligence evaluations of the British and the French. Grobke had claimed 74 operational boats, a predictable overestimate when talking big to a foreign intelligence officer. But even exaggerating, Grobke had not gone as high as 100. 50 U-boats were almost certainly the undersea strength of Nazi Germany, give or take 5, with perhaps only 13 under construction. In 1918 alone, Germany had lost more than 100 U-boats. Then came the crucial paragraph, which he had typed with many pauses and which he anxiously read over and over. What follows gets into prognostication, and so may be judged frivolous or journalistic. However, the impression that this observer has formed points so strongly to a single possibility that it seems necessary to record the judgment. All the evidence indicates to me that Adolf Hitler is, at this time, negotiating a military alliance with the Soviet Union. Arguing in support of his idea, Victor Henry alluded to the Rapallo Treaty of 1922, when the Bolsheviks and the Germans had stunned a European economic conference by suddenly going off and making a separate deal of broad scope. He pointed out that the present German ambassador in Moscow, Schulenburg, was a Rapallo man. Litvinov, Russia's Jewish pro-Western foreign minister, had recently fallen. Hitler, in 2 speeches, had left out his usual attacks on Bolshevism. A Russo-German trade agreement had been in the news, but suddenly the papers had dropped all mention of it. He cited, too, the remark of a man high in the U-boat command, "Watch the East. Something's happening in the East. I have a brother in the foreign ministry." And he cited Hitler's pledge to the U-boat officers that there would be no war over Poland. None of this, he acknowledged, added up to hard intelligence, nor did it impress the professionals at the embassy. There were always, they said, rumors of theatrical surprises. They insisted on sticking to basic facts. The Nazi movement was built on fear and hate of Bolshevism and a pledge to destroy it. The whole theme of Mein Kampf was conquest of living room for Germany in the southeast provinces of Russia. A military reconciliation between the two systems was unthinkable. Hitler would never propose it. If he did, Stalin, assuming that it was a trick, would never accept it. The words Henry had encountered most often were fantasy and melodrama. He maintained, nevertheless, that the move not only made sense, but was inevitable. Hitler was far out on a limb in his threats against Poland. A dictator could not back down. Yet his combat readiness for a world war was marginal. Probably to avoid alarming the people, he had not even put his country on a war production basis, contrary to all the lurid, blustering propaganda of cannon instead of butter. Despite this tough talk of Nazi politicians and newspapers, the man in the street did not want a war, and Hitler knew that. A Russian alliance was a way out of the dilemma. If Russia gave the Germans a free hand in Poland, the English guarantee would become meaningless. Neither the French nor the British could possibly come to Poland's aid in time to avert a quick conquest. Therefore, the Poles would not fight. They would yield the city of Danzig and the extraterritorial road across the British corridor, which was all Hitler was demanding. Maybe later, as in the case of Czechoslovakia, he would move in and take the rest of Poland, but not now. Victor Henry argued that the sudden reversal of alliances was an old European stratagem, especially characteristic of German and Russian diplomacy. He cited many instances, fresh from his heavy history reading. He pointed out that Hitler himself had come to power in the first place through a sharp reversal of political lines, a deal with his worst enemy, Franz von Papen. Fully clothed, he fell asleep on the red leather couch, with the report and two carbon copies tucked inside his shirt, after shredding the sheets of carbon paper into the wastebasket. His slumber was restless and brief. When his eyes popped wide open again, the sun was sending weak red rays through the treetops. He showered, dressed, read the report again, and walked 5 miles from the Grunewald to the Wilhelmstrasse, turning the document over in his mind. Compared to Tolliver's reports, which he had studied, it was a presumptuous discussion of grand strategy, far beyond his competence and his position. The sort of Drew Pearson column against which the chief of naval operations himself had warned him. On the other hand, it seemed to him factual. He had already sent in a number of technical reports like Kipp's papers. He intended to write one on Swinemunde. Combat readiness of Nazi Germany was a jump into the dark. In War College seminars, instructors had poked rude fun at global masterminding by officers below flag rank. The question was, now that the paper was written, should he send it or forget it? Pug Henry had written and later destroyed many such documents. He had a continuing tendency to reach beyond routine. The result could be good or disastrous. His unsolicited memorandum on the battleship blisters had knocked him out of overdue sea duty and landed him in Berlin. That report, at least, had been within his professional sphere as an ordnance man. In diplomacy and grand strategy, he was a naive newcomer. Colonel Forrest knew Germany well, and he had waved aside Henry's suggestion as nonsense. Pug had ventured to talk to the chargé d'affaires, whose only comment had been a subtle smile. A Foreign Service courier was flying to England at 10 a.m. to board the New York-bound Queen Mary. The document could be on CNO's desk in a week. Henry arrived at the embassy, still undecided, with not much more than a half hour in which to make up his mind. Except for Rhoda, there was nobody whose advice he could ask. Rhoda liked to sleep late. If he called her now, he would probably wake her, and even then he could scarcely describe the report on the German telephone. But would Rhoda, in any case, offer a judgment worth having? He thought not. It was up to him. The courier or the burn basket. He sat at his desk in the high-ceilinged, cluttered office, sipping coffee, looking out across Hermann Göringstrasse at Hitler's monumental new chancellery of pink marble. The sentry guards were changing. 8 helmeted, black-clad, heavy SS men marching up, 8 others marching away to a drum and fife. Through the open windows, he heard the ritual orders in shrill German, the squeal of the fife, the scraping tramp of the big black boots. Victor Henry decided that his job was intelligence, and that for better or worse, this report told truly what he had seen so far in Nazi Germany. He hunted up the courier and gave him the document for urgent delivery to the Office of Naval Intelligence. Admiral Preble read Combat Readiness of Nazi Germany a week later and sent one page of extracts to the president. The Nazi-Soviet pact broke on the world on the 22nd of August as one of the most stunning surprises in all history. On the 24th, Preble received the page back in an envelope from the White House. The president had scrawled at the bottom, in strong, thick penstrokes in black ink, "Let me have V. Henry's service record. FDR." Chapter 7 The announcement of the pact shrieked at Byron and Natalie from the news placards in the Rome airport. They had set out from Siena before dawn in an old Renault, and while the whole world was chattering about the astounding news, they had innocently driven down along the Apennines in golden Italian sunlight, amid old mountain towns, wild airy gorges, and green valleys where peasants worked their fields. With Natalie Jastrow at his side for a 3-week journey that was only starting, Byron was in the highest of spirits, until he saw the bulletins. He had never found a European airport so busy or so noisy. Gesticulating travelers were besieging the reservation desks. Nearly everybody was either walking fast or running, and sweaty porters wheeling heaps of luggage were snarling at passengers and at each other. The loudspeaker never stopped its thunderous, echoing drivel. At the first kiosk, he bought a sheaf of papers. The Italian papers shrilled that this great diplomatic coup by the Axis had ended the war danger. The headlines of the Paris and London newspapers were big, black, and frightened. The German press giggled coarse delight in tall red block letters. The front page of a Swiss newspaper caricatured Hitler and Goering in Russian blouses and fur hats, squatting and kicking out their boots to the music of a concertina played by Stalin in an SS uniform. Across a Belgian front page, the stark headline was, 1914? In a crowded, buzzing airport restaurant, while they ate a hasty lunch of cannelloni and cold white wine, Natalie astonished him by talking of going on. To proceed into a country that might soon be invaded by Germans struck Byron as almost mad. But Natalie argued that the tourists milling in the airport were mere sheep. If a sudden political change could panic them, they had no right to be in Europe. She had stayed in Paris through the Munich crisis. Half of her American friends had fled and later had straggled back, those who had not felt too silly. There was always less danger than most people thought. Even in a war, an American passport spelled safety. She wanted to see Poland. She wanted to see Leslie Sloat, and had given him her promise. She would be in and out of Poland in 3 weeks. The world wasn't going to end in 3 weeks. It did not cheer Byron to perceive how much she really wanted to rejoin Sloat. Since the polio, he had hoped that she was warming to himself. The girl had been downright affectionate during the second polio, which they had watched without Jastrow, and at one point in the evening, when they were well into a third bottle of Suave at dinner after the race, she had remarked that it was too bad he wasn't a few years older and a Jew. "My mother would take to you, Briny," she had said. "My troubles would be over. You have good manners. You must have lovely parents. Leslie Sloat is nothing but an ambitious, self-centered dog. I'm not even sure he loves me. He and I just fell in a hole." But now she was on her way to her lover, and a political explosion that had staggered Europe made no difference to her. By now he knew something of her rash streak. Climbing on mountainsides or ruins, Natalie Jastrow took unladylike chances. She leaped gaps. She teetered along narrow ledges. She scrambled up bare rocks, careless alike of her modesty and her neck. She was a strong, sure-footed girl, and a little too pleased with herself about it. He sat, slouched in his chair, contemplating her across the red and white checked cloth, the dirty dishes, the empty wine glasses. The Alitalia plane was departing for Zagreb on the first leg of their flight in little more than an hour. She stared back, her lips pushed out in a wry pout. Her dark gray traveling suit was sharply tailored over her pretty bosom. She wore a black, crushable hat and a white shirt. Her ringless fingers beat on the cloth. "Look," she said, "I can well understand that for you it's no longer a gay excursion, so I'll go on by myself." "I suggest you telephone Sloat first. Ask him if you should come." Natalie drummed her fingers. "Nonsense. I'll never get a call through to Warsaw today." "Try." "All right," she snapped. "Where are the damn telephones?" The long-distance office was mobbed. Two switchboard girls were shouting, plugging, unplugging, scrawling, waving their hands, and wiping sweat from their brows. Byron cut through the crowd, pulling Natalie by the hand. When she gave the operator a number in Warsaw, the girl's sad, huge brown eyes widened.
"Signorina, Warsaw, why don't you ask me to ring President Roosevelt? It's 12 hours delay to Warsaw."
"That's the number of the American embassy there," Byron said, smiling at her, "and it's life and death." He had an odd, thin-lipped smile, half melancholy, half gay, and the Italian girl warmed to it, as to an offered bunch of violets.
"American embassy, I can try."
She plugged, rang, argued in German and Italian, made faces at the mouthpiece, and argued some more.
"Urgent! Emergency!" she kept shouting.
This went on for 10 minutes or more, while Byron smoked and Natalie paced and kept looking at her watch. With a surprised look, the operator, all at once, nodded violently, pointing to a booth. Natalie stayed inside a long time and came out red-faced and scowling. "We were cut off before we finished. I'm choking to death. Let's get some air." Byron brought her out into the terminal. "He got angry with me. He told me I was insane. The diplomats are burning their papers. It was an awfully good connection. He might have been around the corner." "I'm sorry, Natalie, but it's what I expected." "He said I should get the hell out of Italy and go straight home, with or without Aaron. Is that what you'd have told me?" She turned on him.
"I'm so hot. Buy me a lemonade or something."
They sat at a little table outside an airport cafe. She said, "Let's see the plane tickets." "I'm sure we can get refunds." He handed her the envelope. She extracted her ticket and gave the envelope back. "You get a refund. They burned papers before Munich, too. England and France will fold up now just the way they did then. Imagine a world war over Danzig. Who the hell knows where Danzig is? Who cares?" "Natalie, that embassy will be swamped. You won't see much of him." "Well, if he's too busy for me, I'll do my sightseeing alone. My family lived in Warsaw for years. I still have relatives there. I want to see it. I'm on my way, and I'm not turning back." The girl looked in her pocketbook mirror and jammed her hat further down on her head. "It must be about time for me to check in." He held out his hand. "Give me the ticket. I'll check both of us in while you have your lemonade." She brightened, but looked suspicious. "Are you sure you want to go? You needn't, honestly. I'm releasing you. Don't come. I don't want you. Tell Aaron I said that."
"Oh, shut up, Natalie. Let's have the ticket."
She gave him a playful smile, clutching the green and yellow ticket to her bosom. "Well, listen to Briny Henry being masterful. The thing is, darling, if anything does go wrong, I don't ever want to feel I dragged you into trouble." This was the first time Natalie Jastrow had, however casually, used a term of endearment to him. Byron stood up and pulled the ticket from her gloved hand. The scheduled 8-hour trip lasted a day and a half. No connections worked. Their baggage vanished. They spent the night on benches in the Budapest terminal. At Warsaw, they were the only foreigners arriving at the small field in the nearly empty, rusty, shabby Lot plane, which turned right around and took off jam-packed with people fleeing Poland. Disconsolate travelers crowded the fence and watched it go. A beefy young Pole in an olive uniform, speaking broken French, asked the two Americans many hostile questions and seemed to regard them as spies or lunatics. He confiscated their passports, muttered with other officials, told them to wait, and disappeared. They were famished, but the throng of refugees in the canteen, mostly Germans, sitting on luggage, squatting on the floor, or crowding every bench and chair, had long since eaten up all the food. Byron pounced on a couple of seats vacated for a moment. Bottles of warm Polish beer stood in the center of the table, with an opener and some glasses, so they drank warm beer and paid the waiter who came swooping down. Then Byron found a telephone and talked the waiter into calling the embassy. Sloat was shocked to hear his voice. He appeared at the airport within the hour, chewing nervously on his cold pipe, in a shiny blue Chevrolet that prompted stares. Out came not only the passports, with various entry documents badly printed in purple ink on crude paper, but their luggage, too. Mysteriously rescued from the Balkans, they piled into the embassy car and set off for the city. Natalie looked trim and pert after a last grooming in the ladies' lounge, the size of a telephone booth, she said, with one cold water tap and no seat on the single toilet bowl. "Does this continue, Leslie?" she said. "I mean, this is the airport of the capital of Poland. The further east we've come, the smaller the airports have gotten, the more loused up the schedules, the worse the airplanes, the surlier the officials, the cruder the Johns, and the rougher the toilet paper. I'm not sure my bottom would survive a trip to Russia."
"Well, Eastern Europe is another world, Natalie, and you're seeing it at a bad time. This little airport's usually deserted and half asleep. However," he jabbed the stem of his pipe toward her, "if you choose to go on a pleasure trip during a time of general mobilization—" "Here it comes, Briny," she said, her eyes full of dark amusement. Sloat reached a caressing hand with a large blue-gemmed college ring to her face. The easy, intimate gesture hurt Byron's eyes, signaling the end of his exclusive, if unheated, possession of the girl's company. He slumped glumly in the back seat. "I'm thrilled to see you, darling, though you're stark mad," Sloat said. "Things are looking much better tonight. England finally signed her guarantee to Poland just today. The betting was that the pact with Russia would make her crawfish. Nothing of the sort. There's reliable word from Sweden that Hitler's calling off his invasion. The English knocked his breath out. That's unmistakable." "Where are you putting us? A place with bathtubs, I hope."
"It's no problem. In the past 3 days, the hotels have emptied. The Europeisky has some luxurious rooms, quite Western, really, and at Eastern prices. Don't figure on staying long. The situation can still turn sour overnight.
I thought maybe a week,
Natalie said. Then Byron and I can fly or drive down to Krakow and visit Medjic, and then fly on back to Rome.
Great bloody Christ, what are you talking about, Medjic? Just forget it, Natalie.
Why should I? Uncle Aaron said I should go visit the family in Medjic. That's where we're all from.
My gosh, this is flat country, flat as a table.
They were driving through fields of sweet-smelling ripe grain, interspersed with pastures where cows and horses grazed. Far, far ahead on the level plain, the buildings of Warsaw dimly rose.
Exactly, and that's Poland's curse. It's a soccer field, 100,000 square miles in size, fine for invasions. Even the low mountains along the south have nice, wide, easy passes. Half a million German soldiers are in Czechoslovakia at this moment, poised at the Jablunka Pass, 40 miles from Medjic. Now, do you understand?
Natalie made a face at him. Warsaw was much calmer than Rome. In lamplit twilight, well-dressed crowds, heavily sprinkled with uniforms, were happily promenading on the broad avenues, eating ice cream, smoking, chatting. The green parks were thronged with jocund children. Bright red buses went by with side placards advertising a movie. The name Shirley Temple stood out from Polish words. Splashy billboards touted German toothpastes, radios, and hair tonic. The long rows of four-story gray or brown buildings, the boulevards running into great squares flamboyant with statues, bordered by Baroque official buildings or palaces, the electric signs beginning to flash and dance, all this made Byron think of Paris and London. It was strange to find such a metropolis at the end of the primitive air journey. The Europeisky Hotel had a lobby as ornate as any he had seen, with a massive brown-and-white marble staircase jutting down to the front door. Natalie went up in the elevator. Sloat detained Byron by touching his arm, then lit his pipe with harried flaming puffs. To Byron, seeing him after a lapse of many months, the Foreign Service man appeared impossibly old for Natalie. Bespeckled, baggy-eyed, with marked lines in his lean, sallow cheeks. A double-breasted, chalk-striped dark suit emphasized his stodgy, mature air, and he appeared shorter than Byron remembered.
"I wish I had time to buy you a drink," Sloat said. "I'd like to talk to you. This Krakow trip is dangerous nonsense. I'm going to get you air reservations out of here as soon as I can. They must be booked solid for a week, but the embassy has some pull. If it takes both of us to put her bodily on a plane back to Rome, it's got to be done. Don't tell her tonight, though. She'll become unmanageable."
"Okay, you know her better than I do."
Sloat shook his head, laughing.
"I wonder at this point. I ought to be deeply touched by this cuckoo visit, and I am. I am, of course I am. But Natalie Jastrow is too much for almost anybody. See you at dinner. The embassy's a madhouse. If I can't get away, I'll telephone."
Byron sat for a while in his cavernous, gloomy room with tall windows facing the Bristol Hotel, wondering what the hell he was doing in Poland. He picked up the antique, ivory-handled telephone, and with some haggling in German, managed to get connected to Natalie's room.
"Hello. Are you in the bathtub yet?"
"Well, I'm glad you can't see me. What's up?"
"I'm beat. You have dinner with Sloat. I'm going to bed."
"Stop that rubbish. You're dining with us, Briny. You come and fetch me at 9, do you hear? Leslie has booked me into Paderewski's suite or something. It's fantastic. I've got a full-length mirror here, held up by 2 big brown wooden angels."
This way, Sloat said. Our table's ready. An orchestra in gold-frogged red coats was thumping old jazz tunes in the main dining room of the Bristol, which, for size, silk hangings, white linen, gilt and crystal chandeliers, obsequiousness of waiters, fine dress of the thronging customers, and ineptness on the dance floor, might have been in any first-class hotel in Europe. Certainly there was no trace of a war scare. "Sorry I'm late. It's the Jews." Sloat apologized when they sat down. "They're storming the embassy. We've all become visa officers, right on up to Biddle. Christ knows I don't blame them. If they can show a relative, a friend, a letter, anything, we process them. A New York telephone book today in Warsaw is worth 100 zlotys. That's about $20. "That puzzled me," Natalie said. "I understood Warsaw was full of Jews. I've seen very few so far." "Oh, they're here all right. A third of this city's Jewish." At this point, a tail-coated, bowing head waiter brought a menu, and Sloat had a long colloquy with him in Polish. Natalie listened with an admiring, envious look. "Less, was it very hard to learn? One day I'll try," she said as the waiter left. "My folks used to talk Polish when they didn't want me to understand. I'm haunted by a sense of being back in my childhood, and yet this is such a foreign place. It's all very singular." They ate amazingly good smoked salmon, a strange egg dish, and tough roast meat. Sloat kept tossing off brown Polish vodka in a thimble-sized glass, while the others drank good French wine. "Leslie, you're going to be stone drunk." Natalie sounded more jovial than disapproving. "There's so little in every glass," Sloat said, pouring more from the bottle. "I've had a very hard day, even without you turning up, you fool." They smiled at each other. Byron wished he had gone to bed. Sloat looked at him and, with a polite effort, resumed talking. Yes, it's a historical puzzle, really, how 3.5 million Jews came to settle in Poland. It's such an anarchic country. You'd think they'd have chosen a more stable place. I have a theory. I sort of wonder what Aaron would make of it." "What's your theory about us Polish Jews, Leslie?" Natalie said with a grin. "That the anarchy was the inducement. Imagine a government of nearly 1,000 barons, any one of whom could veto any legislation. That's the way they stumbled along here for centuries. No wonder Poland kept getting partitioned. Well, as long as the Jews could work things out with each individual nobleman, they could at least live and farm and work. No royal oppression to fear." "Not bad," said Natalie. "But in point of fact, didn't the Polish kings welcome them in with special protective laws? When Spain expelled them and the Holy Church was having one of its bad spasms of hounding and massacring the Jews, that's as I recall it." "I haven't studied the thing," Sloat said, "but the Poles eventually took to doing that too." "That's why I was born on Long Island," said Natalie. "My grandfather got out, and a good thing." "What military shape are the Poles in?" Byron asked Sloat. "Will they give Hitler a fight, if it comes to that?"
"A fight?"
Sloat sucked on his pipe, looking up into the air. His tone turned measured and professional. "Why, ask any one of them, and he'll probably tell you they'll defeat the Germans. After all, they defeated them in 1410. These are strange people, Byron. They can be brilliant, talking about politics and history, yet they don't give a damn that Germany is now an industrial giant, while Poland remains all farms and Jews and castles and mazurkas. Maybe they're right. Maybe the Polish fighting spirit will scatter the stupid, unwilling cattle of Hitler. That's the talk." There are supposed to be 2.5 million Poles in uniform, more men than Hitler's got. A highly questionable figure. But in this country, any statistics...
Say, isn't that stardust? Natalie put in. It sounds a bit like stardust. Dance with me.
Byron thought Sloat looked more like her uncle than her sweetheart, steering her clumsily around the floor. But Natalie's clinging attitude, closed eyes, and touching cheek weren't the ways of a niece. They exchanged a few laughing words. Then Natalie said something that made Sloat look serious and shake his head. They argued as they danced.
"I'll find him without you," Natalie was saying as they came back to the table. "I didn't say I wouldn't help you find him. I said, if you're going to talk to him about going to Medjic, just forget it. Forget I mentioned it."
Natalie glowered at the meat on her plate. Sloat took 2 more shots of vodka. To lighten the atmosphere, Byron asked Sloat about the workings of the embassy. Looking relieved, Sloat turned on the measured voice. The alcohol hadn't blurred his brain. It made him talkative. He sketched the organization and said that he was in the political section, but that since his arrival he had been preoccupied with the flood of emigrants, as had everybody else. "Were you fellows surprised by the pact?"
"Naturally.
Even the Poles were struck dumb, and in their history they've seen everything. But nobody can predict Hitler. That's his genius, if you want to call it that. He does have an instinct for the breathtaking." The cloud was clearing from Natalie's face. "Leslie, why did Stalin go along?"
"Honey, that's perfectly simple. Hitler offered him a piece of cake on a gold platter.
And he simply said, 'Yes, thank you.'
Stalin's completely turned the tables on England and France now. They froze him out of Munich. In effect, they handed Czechoslovakia to Hitler and said, 'Here, boy, leave us alone and go smash Russia.' Now Stalin's done a Munich in reverse. 'No, no, here, boy, take Poland and go and smash the West.'"
With little rapid puffs of blue smoke, clearly enjoying the chance to expound, Sloat went on.
"Lord, how the British have been asking for this. An alliance with Russia was their one chance to stop Germany. They had years in which to do it. All of Stalin's fear of Germany and the Nazis was on their side. And what did they do? Dawdle, fuss, flirt with Hitler, and give away Czechoslovakia. Finally, finally, they sent some minor politicians on a slow boat to see Stalin. When Hitler decided to gamble on this alliance, he shot his foreign minister to Moscow on a special plane with powers to sign a deal. And that's why we're within inches of a world war."
"Is it going to come?" Natalie asked.
"Why, I thought you and Aaron were the authorities for the view that it won't.
I'm not ready to panic. It just seems to me that Hitler will get what he wants, as usual."
Sloat's face turned pinched and somber. He pulled at the pipe, sucking in his pallid cheeks. "No, the Poles now have the signed British guarantee. Very gallant, very irrational, very belated, and probably futile. To that extent, we're back in 1914. Poland can plunge the world in by standing firm. It's all up to Hitler. If he wants to arm some more first, the crisis will subside, and that seems to be in the wind at the moment. But for all we know, he's already given the order to march.
That's why I'm being such a pill about Medjic. Down there, in the next 2 weeks, you have a 50-50 chance of being captured by German soldiers. I do think that's a bit risky, dear."
After dinner, Sloat drove them to another part of town. Street after street of old brick houses of 3 and 4 stories, with shops everywhere at ground level. Here, indeed, were Jews by the thousands, strolling on the sidewalks through narrow cobbled streets, looking out of windows,
sitting in shop doorways. On the street corners, knots of bearded men argued with loud voices and sweeping gestures, as on Manhattan's Lower East Side. Many of the men wore caftans, or else the boots, blouses, and caps of the countryside. There were men in ankle-length black coats and black hats, and a few youngsters in army uniform. There were some prosperous people, too. Smooth-shaven men wearing bowlers and well-groomed women, looking much like the Warsaw Gentiles around the Europeisky. Children darted about at their street games, boys in caps and short trousers, and girls in neat colored frocks, and their mothers gossiped as they watched them. "I thought you said they were all storming the embassy," Byron remarked to Sloat. "There are 350,000 of them, Byron. Maybe 1 in 100 has foresight. That puts 3,000 or 4,000 hammering at our doors. The rest believe what they want to believe, and vaguely hope for the best. The government keeps telling everybody there won't be a war." Natalie was looking around with an absent, pleased expression at the horse-drawn wagons and handcarts in the street, and at an old trolley car clanking by. "My parents described all this to me when I was a child," she said. "It seems not to have changed." People stopped and looked after the embassy car as it passed. Once Sloat halted to ask directions. The Jews came clustering around, but gave only vague, cautious answers in Polish. "Let me try," Natalie said, and she began to talk Yiddish, causing an astonished outbreak of laughter, followed by a burst of warm, friendly talk. A chubby boy in a ragged cap volunteered to run ahead of the car and show the way. They set off after him. "Well done," Sloat said. "I can hack out Yiddish after a fashion, if I must," Natalie said. "Aaron's a master of it, though he never utters a Yiddish word." Natalie and Sloat got out at the gray brick apartment building with tall, narrow windows, an ornate iron door, and window boxes of blooming geraniums. It overlooked a small green park where Jews congregated on the benches and around a gushing fountain in noisy numbers. Curious children ran from the park to ring Byron in the American car. Under their merry stares, as they freely discussed him and the machine, Byron felt somewhat like an ape behind glass. The faces of the Jewish children were full of life and mischief, but they offered no discourtesy, and some gave him shy smiles. He wished he had gifts for them. He took his fountain pen from his pocket and, through the open window, offered it to a black-haired girl in a lilac dress with white lace cuffs and collar. The girl hung back, blinking wary, dark brown eyes. The other children encouraged her with shouts and giggles. At last she took the pen, her little cool fingers brushing his hand for a moment, and ran lightly away. "Well, wouldn't you know, he's not there," Natalie said, returning to the car with Sloat a few minutes later. "Gone to Medjich for his son's wedding, with the whole family. Oh, just my luck. Aaron told me he deals in mushrooms, but can that be such a good business? He's evidently well off."
"Unusually so." Sloat was starting the car. "This must be the best apartment house around here."
The little girl in lilac reappeared, leading her parents, the father in a knee-length gray frock coat and a wide-brimmed gray hat, the mother kerchiefed, wearing a German-tailored brown suit and carrying a baby in a pink blanket.
"He's thanking you," Sloat said to Byron, as the father gravely spoke in Polish through the window, holding the fountain pen. "And he says it's much too expensive, and please take it back. Tell him the American fell in love with his daughter. She's the most beautiful girl in the world, and she must keep it." The father and mother laughed when Sloat translated.
The little girl shrank against her mother's skirt and shot Byron an ardent look. The mother undid from her lapel a gold brooch with purple stones and pressed it on Natalie, who tried to decline it, speaking in Yiddish. Again, this caused surprise and a cascade of jocund talk, the upshot of which was that she had to keep the brooch. The little girl kept the pen, and they drove off to shouted farewells.
"Well, I wasn't on a looting expedition," Natalie said. "Here, Byron, it's beautiful. Give it to your girlfriend, or your sister, or your mother."
"Keep it, it's yours," he said rudely. "I could consider staying in Warsaw and waiting for that girl to grow up."
"Not with those parents," Sloat said. "She's for a rabbi."
"Steer clear of Jewish girls anyway. They're bad joss," Natalie said.
"Amen," said Sloat.
Natalie was pinning the brooch on her jacket.
"I guess I'll see Beryl in Medjich, then."
"Too bad. Aaron said he was very clever and could show me things in Warsaw that nobody else could. They used to study the Talmud together, though Beryl was much younger."
At the mention of Medjich, Sloat despairingly shook his head. Chapter 8 Natalie telephoned Byron in his room at 7 o'clock one morning, after they had stayed up till well past 3, touring nightclubs with Sloat. Dismal Polish imitations of Paris dives. In a nervously merry mood, she had pushed them on from one club to another, ignoring Sloat's show of collapsing fatigue.
"Hi, Briny. Are you dead?"
From her chipper note, she might have had 10 hours sleep.
"This is playing sort of dirty, but I have